She'd been the candidate to defeat the longtime strongman of Belarus. This week, she watched his secret inauguration, capping off a rigged election.
We are fighting for the future of our children. We have changed, and we want our country to be changed. We want a democratic country.
My conversation with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the woman many people say should be the president of Belarus. Also today, calls to abolish immigration and customs enforcement, and a theory about why hundreds of whales became stranded on a beach in Australia. Some experts think their cries for help may have endangered more of them.
So they send out these distress signals, so more whales come to them to kind of rescue them, see if they're okay, and unfortunately they get stranded in the process as well.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement poured into the streets of Louisville, Kentucky yesterday. Chanting the name Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old emergency room technician who was shot in the hallway of her apartment by police officers executing a search warrant. Activists have been demanding that all three officers be held accountable. Yesterday, a grand jury indicted one former detective on the charge of first-degree wanton endangerment. Two other officers faced no charges. Yesterday's protest was mostly peaceful, but it also turned tense.
Under Kentucky state law, this is an unlawful assembly, and we command all persons so assembled here to immediately and peacefully disperse.
Then, violent when two Louisville police officers were shot with non-life-threatening injuries. Protesters in many other American cities also demonstrated against the verdicts. In June, in the weeks after the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd, we reached out to Siana Bangura and Miski Noor. Siana is an author, poet, and activist in London. Miski is an organizer and writer with Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis. They're with us again. Hello, Miski. Hi, Siana.
Hi.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having us.
I'd like to start with the news from Louisville. When you heard the grand jury's decision, Miski, what was your reaction?
Wow. So when I heard it, I was actually texting with a friend, and I texted them that I was ashamed, that I wasn't surprised. And their response was, you know, you don't have to be ashamed. What's sad is that it is unsurprising, but it can still be hurtful, right? And I think it's just more proof of exactly why we will never get true justice through the criminal injustice system here in America, and why we can't depend on policing to actually care for our people or the court system to give the families of the victims of police violence true justice.
Siana Bangura there in London, how did you take in the news, and what are you hearing from other activists you work with?
Like others, I'm not surprised. And I think this is the problem. We should never be numb to this, right? We should never be numb to Black pain. We should never be numb to violence against any of us. But we in the Black communities across the diaspora often aren't surprised, really. And I think for me, there's just a stark difference between the story of Breonna Taylor and the story of George Floyd. And that is how Breonna Taylor was used and used and used and used again. She got magazine covers and celebrities are talking about her. Everything is happening except actual justice. It's just really sad that we're not surprised. But I think I'm always actively trying not to be numb to these things, because I do think if it hurts, if you still feel the pain, it just reminds you that you are alive and you still care.
The three of us spoke in June, a couple of weeks after the death of George Floyd. It felt like everyone in the United States and in the world had their eyes on Minneapolis. Miski, what's life been like in Minneapolis for you since then?
The city has continued to take care of one another in really beautiful ways, I think, is the first thing that I want to share. George Floyd Square is still open and community members are still holding space. There was just a self-care rally there the other day. And our folks are really continuing to fight. So we've since been out in the streets talking to our neighbors with a community-led survey, trying to talk to them about the ways in which they're actually keeping one another safe. Folks have continued to take to the streets and folks have continued to organize with one another. And so it's been really incredible to see that the energy here has really been sustained as folks have continued to take action.
Siana, what is your sense? What have the past 3 months or so been like for you?
you know, firstly, I'm really happy to hear that there's been sustained effort across the pond. And I think that that speaks to the urgency of the matter. I think what it feels like in the UK is that that initial, you know, it's predictable and inevitable, but that initial maybe sense of urgency isn't the same as it was when we last spoke. You know, if you think about kind of struggle, comparing it to maybe a sprint versus a marathon, it feels like we're moving in this kind of like marathon bit now where, okay, people are needing like stamina, people are needing that kind of long-term commitment. The media isn't on it in the same way as it was, and the conversations aren't live in the same way they were. People involved in kind of Black Lives Matter and various different BLM movements in the UK are, you know, trying to get others to pay attention. And there's a lot of resistance. I think even those who can kind of, you know, support Black Lives Matter in the UK, there's still even tension within that, though, to what extent when it comes to talking about abolishing the police, to talking about even looking at like the military industrial complex as like a sister demand when we think about abolition. So I think we're just in a different stage now. Things have slowed down for sure. And I think now's the time to really see what people are made of. Now's the time to see, now that, you know, it's not popping on Instagram and the black squares have gone and all those kinds of things, it's now kind of like, what are you really made of and what is your real commitment to this cause? So that's kind of where it feels like we're at the moment, to be quite honest.
So historically in the United States, slavery is the original sin and the legacy of it. Jim Crow laws, persistent inequalities in housing, education, jobs. In your work, Miskie, do you see the conversation shifting? Do you think a significant number of Americans are starting to reexamine their past in a new way that gives you hope?
We see stats like, you know, hundreds of thousands of white people now purchasing Ibram Kendi's book, right? But I don't necessarily think that that means that the change that we want is happening, especially when we consider the Black feminist authors that we actually need people reading to make that necessary shift.
You're referring, of course, to Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Is there a majority of the public shifting? I think there's been a huge shift in the conversation around policing. And I think there's been a huge shift around people actually really realizing that reform isn't possible. And we've seen these huge shifts before. And so I think like what actually gives me hope is what I see being the long-term transformative change possible in the community members who I've seen like take deep interest and deep action alongside each other to really transform their relationships and transform, therefore, the safety that is possible in our neighborhoods. And I feel like that's where a lot of the hope comes from. And I think the changing public opinion makes more space for that. And I think the hope comes from not only those conversations being had, but people actually changing their beliefs and actions and talking to one another to make that possible.
Siyana Bangura, author, poet, and activist in London, and Miskie Noor, a writer who's with Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis. Thanks very much again.
Thank you so much. Always love this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Our next guest was almost the next president of Belarus. Many in Belarus and across Europe say the August presidential election there was rigged, and Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is the true president. She joins us now from Vilnius in Lithuania, where she's in exile. Thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Tikhanovskaya. To start off, just yesterday, the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, held a secret, unannounced inauguration for himself. He took the oath of office. What do you make of this moment as you look on from Lithuania?
You know, it was expectable that he will make this in secret because we see that he is afraid of his people. He doesn't feel support of his people. But it doesn't make any sense because he was, in the eyes of Belarusian people, he was illegitimate just right after 9th of August, and he is staying legitimate now. So nothing has changed since his secret inauguration.
Lukashenko, we have to remember, has been the president of Belarus for 26 years, and he says he won. You and many others see a rigged election. Why did you leave Belarus? Why did you not stay and fight?
Why was I kicked out of Belarus, you mean?
Well, are you saying you were kicked out or did you leave voluntarily?
Oh, the fact is that I'm not in Belarus, okay? I'm here and let's say I was made to leave But I couldn't leave, you know, my people, because it really was a frightening moment for me, escaping from Belarus. And I was really, for a couple of days, I stayed shocked in Lithuania, in Vilnius, and I wasn't sure that I would continue struggling. But I got such support from Belarusian people who understood my action, why I left Belarus, and just we have to move on until victory.
Ms. Tikhanovskaya, you've taken more leadership roles recently, making strong statements in front of the UN and the EU. Are you just pushing ahead, acting as president in some ways? I mean, do you see yourself as the true president of Belarus, but in exile?
In reality, it doesn't matter how people call me, because people call me a national leader and symbol of freedom and national elected president. I feel myself as a person who is with Belarusian people during the election period, who promised Belarusian people that I will not step away as long as they will fight for these changes. I will fight with them. So it happened that people call me a national leader and they gave me this right to represent the majority of people who don't want Lukashenko anymore. So I use this right and speak on behalf of Belarusian people. So I never say I'm the president of the Republic of Belarus. No, I say that I'm the same as any other person in Belarus, but I try to do everything I can for the future of our country.
I'm speaking with the Belarusian presidential candidate and opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Interestingly, the three main leaders of the opposition are women, and many of the people who've been arrested across Belarus are women. How significant is that?
You know, it wasn't prepared action. You know, it just happened. It's our fate, I suppose. Women of Belarus understood that there is the very moment when every person matters. And women don't have to be on the kitchens. Every woman found strength in herself just to stand in front of men, because we are brave, we are wonderful.
Ms. Tikhanovskaya, yesterday you recorded a video op-ed for the New York Times. The title is The Housewife and the Dictator. In the print edition, it was, "I was a stay-at-home mom, now I'm leading a revolution." Why is it important for you to present yourself to the American people in that way? What do you want Americans to understand about the situation in Belarus that you're facing?
I want to explain what does it mean for Belarusian people who lived for 26 years in dictatorship under the regime. Some children were born with this dictator and they feel this fear inside of them during the whole day life. I also was afraid during the whole election campaign. I was afraid every moment that police will come and will take me to the prison and my children will stay alone. And I wanted to show that we are brave. What we are doing now, it is history. And our Belarusian people, they changed their minds and they will never come back to the state they used to live for 26 years. So I wanted all the people around to feel the situation in Belarus, just for them to see that there is a woman who ran for presidency just for love, and then she became a national leader, not because she needs power, because I don't want to be the president, but just we are fighting for the future of our children. We don't want our children to be slaves. We want to build a new country for life. That's it.
You are leading a revolution. Do you have time to reflect? Like, have you had a chance to process in the last couple of months how your life has changed and where it could be headed?
For sure it has changed. For sure. What has changed most of all is the sense of responsibility. Because you understand that any your decision, that any your message that you declare influence the situation in the country. And of course, my time, I feel that I'm a woman who spent 24 hours every day with my children, and now I spend too little time with them. But I understand what I'm doing. This for why I'm doing this, that I need to work hard now for the future of my children. So the sense of irresponsibility is what has changed greatly.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is the leader of the Belarusian opposition. She spoke with us from exile in Lithuania. Ms. Tikhanovskaya, thank you very much for your time and for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When it comes to extreme measures, North Korea is in a class by itself.
This could be the most drastic anti-coronavirus measure that any state has taken during the pandemic.
That's reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea. He's describing an incident that happened this week when North Korean troops shot and killed a South Korean fisheries worker. He had crossed over a maritime border into the north. After killing him, the soldiers then doused the man's dead body with oil and set him on fire. It seems to be part of the Pyongyang government shoot-to-kill policy to stop COVID-19 from entering North Korea. Strother says little is known about the South Korean who's crossed over the border.
All South Korea's military says is that he was a 47-year-old official in the Ministry of Fisheries. He was in the Yellow Sea on a boat on Monday, carrying out, you know, some duties for his job when he went missing. All he left behind were his shoes. And then on Tuesday, according to South Korea's military, he was floating on the North Korean side of the northern limit line, the maritime border in the Yellow Sea, when he was approached by North Korean soldiers on their ship. They donned gas masks, questioned him for several hours, opened fire on him, and then burnt his body.
Mm. I know North Koreans are very worried about the spread of the coronavirus in their country. Is that why they disposed with his body in such a grim way?
That's what South Korea's military is saying. They say that this was a part of Pyongyang's measures to keep COVID-19 out of the country. And of course, we all know North Korea hasn't had any coronavirus infections at all, if you believe their propaganda. And the U.S. military here in South Korea said recently that they are aware that North Korea has issued a shoot-to-kill mandate on its border with China.
So that is one part of this story of this South Korean defector going to North Korea. That's also really wild. How unusual is it for someone to be defecting from the South to the North?
Quick answer, pretty much no one wants to go up north. I can only think of a handful of cases in the past decade or so where a South Korean has gone across the border, usually on land, cutting through barbed wire in the demilitarized zone. And often it turns out that these northbound defectors, they either have legal or financial problems. And according to South Korean media, as well as the Ministry of Defense here, this man who died in the Yellow Sea had recently been divorced. He had financial problems and reportedly told some of his colleagues that he was thinking about defecting.
Mm. What has been the reaction from officials in South Korea?
President Moon Jae-in has called this shocking. And, you know, this is a real difficult spot for him. Ever since he became president in 2017, he has pledged to improve ties with North Korea. And that even involved getting North Korea involved back in the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics in 2018. But for the past several months, Pyongyang has pretty much given Seoul the cold shoulder.
So North Korean officials are preparing for a massive military parade on October 10th. The kind of event that could present virus risks, even super spreader risks. Is that parade likely to go ahead anyway?
It would certainly be a huge propaganda fail if the October 10th parade were to be called off because of the coronavirus. Again, the official line up north is that there have been zero infections. And perhaps if they did call off these festivities, that would perhaps be a signal that things aren't as under control as they'd like their people to believe.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thank you very much for your time, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
In England, Last Call is coming a little earlier. Starting tonight, pubs must close their doors at 10. It's the start of new measures to control the coronavirus imposed by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In a televised address, Johnson said the country had reached a perilous turning point. A new government contact tracing app was also launched today. The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. So pubs in England have to close tonight from 10 o'clock. What are some of the other changes that have been imposed, Orla? More lockdowns?
Yeah, so and to add to that, within the pubs, it's now table service only, Marco. So if you remember, the British pub, always a place where everyone gathers around the bar, that's no longer the case. Everyone has to be seated at a table. Restaurants too, closing time is 10 p.m. In regards working and whether you can go to work, what the Prime Minister is now recommending is that people work from home if they can. Just to remind you that only 3 weeks ago, the government launched this big campaign asking everyone to go back to work, encouraging people to go back into the office, that it was safe to do so. And now they've had to backtrack rapidly on that one.
Having to leave the bar an hour early or a few hours early doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Then again, I know pubs in the UK are important communal hangouts. What are you hearing?
Yeah, exactly. And I think just to compare the UK with other countries, and sometimes if people haven't spent that much time in the UK, they may not realise that the pub is sort of the central social scene for people in Britain. In Italy and in France and places, it generally happens around restaurants, but not in the UK. And pub owners that I've spoken to over the last 24 hours are really, really frustrated with this, because what happens with pubs a lot of the times is that people actually don't go to the pub until 8 or 9 at night. So the pub's takings are at their greatest after 9 o'clock until closing time. A couple of months back, we spoke to Gareth Kerr. You might remember he's a bar owner in London. He owns the Cafe Kick Bar in central London. Today, I talked to him this morning and asked him how he felt.
It's nearly worse than the first time around, because from 10 till close is it's the biggest percentage of the day's take. It's a bitter pill to swallow, really. In a sensible way, my fear is that you're going to get people binge drinking early, and you know, you potentially are going to have, you know, what you see at 2 a.m. you're going to start seeing at 10 p.m. you know, and it's going to speed things up, and already England drink pretty quickly. So
will these new measures work, or is it too late for drastic action?
Well, it's hard to know. Again, you know, it's the sort of the million-dollar question. The government is at pains to say these are the first measures that they're undertaking. They are prepared to go much further. If these measures don't curb the virus, well, then we're talking about a stricter lockdown and a fairly bleak winter, going back to the sort of lockdown that we experienced back in March and April. But even in the last 24 hours, scientists have come out to say they think the government isn't doing enough. This is epidemiologist Professor John Edmonds, who himself advises the government.
I don't think that the measures have gone anywhere near far enough. I think we have to put stringent measures in place, and it's really important that we put them in place as fast as possible, because if we don't, then the epidemic doubles, and then it doubles again, and then it doubles again, and so on, until we do put the stringent measures in place. But it will be too late again, and then we'll have the worst of both worlds.
Britain also introduced a new contact tracing app, the second app the UK has launched, right? Are people using it?
Yeah, they launched it today. So already this evening, I was just looking, there has been hundreds of thousands of downloads of the app, which is a good sign. However, the testing system here is under such pressure that there just isn't enough tests available. So even if this app works, we still have the problems with the testing system to sort out.
The World's Orla Barry in London with the latest on the backtracking in the UK on measures to control the coronavirus. Orla, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
You rely on us here at The World for important context, like the latest on the global impact of the coronavirus. Get a jump start before the show on what we're covering. Start your morning with our newsletter, Top of the World, so you can start the day informed. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletter. Environmental news is often bleak. Slashing and burning, extinction, destruction. This writer looks for the good news.
People are experimenting, turning wastelands into places where people can grow their own food and live their own lives with dignity.
Models for saving the planet, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World from GBH Boston and PRX. You may have recently heard the rallying cry, Abolish ICE. That's referring to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. It's a slogan we're likely to hear more as the election nears. So what does Abolish ICE actually mean, both to people who have protested the agency and supported it? Here's The World's Monica Campbell.
Let's go back to September 6, 2001, just days before the terrorist attacks took down the World Trade Towers and killed nearly 3,000 people. George W. Bush is on the White House lawn with Mexico's president, Vicente Fox. They were announcing an effort to cooperate on immigration.
And we're trying to work through a formula that will not penalize the person who's chosen the legal route, and at the same time recognizes the contribution the undocumented has made.
Then, 5 days later, the planes hit and everything changed, including America's immigration policy.
We were, as a country, reeling from mass deaths.
Kevin Johnson is the dean of the University of California, Davis Law School and an immigration expert.
We began thinking as a nation about how to tighten and restrict and toughen our immigration laws.
New policies put immigrants under surveillance, viewed as a threat. Soon after, Congress created the Department of Homeland Security, which would oversee the immigration system and the new Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE.
There was a real turnaround, I'd say a U-turn.
Congress poured cash into immigration enforcement. Border Patrol grew and ICE received billions. So what does ICE do exactly? A lot, but it's best known for detaining and deporting unauthorized immigrants. Under President Obama, ICE became entrenched, cooperating more with local police. Deportations skyrocketed, mostly among immigrants from Mexico and Central America. Then Trump took it to a whole new level.
No one will be immune or exempt from enforcement. And ICE and Border Patrol officers will be allowed to do their jobs the way their jobs are supposed to be done.
Trump issued travel bans and rescinded DACA, which let some younger immigrants worry less about deportation. Next, immigration agents began separating families at the Mexican border. That's when the rallying cry, "Abolish ICE," took hold. It's a catch-all slogan. ICE didn't separate families at the border. Customs and Border Protection mostly did that. But the call is meant to challenge U.S. immigration policies. Silke Shaw leads the Detention Watch Network, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., pushing to close ICE's prison-like detention centers.
We believe nobody should go through that system where their harm is being done to them when they're just trying to determine their status and sort of fight for their case.
Shaw points to medical neglect, deaths in detention, and COVID-19 outbreaks at the facilities. And she asks, why should someone face such conditions? For others, the slogan opens up a debate about transforming ICE. Cesar Cuauhtemoc García Hernández is a law professor at the University of Denver. He says that change doesn't have to mean firing a bunch of federal employees.
There's no reason why a lawyer who currently looks at immigration law for the purpose of deporting people could not retool to look at immigration law for the purpose of identifying people who might be eligible for citizenship.
ICE didn't grant an interview, but some former officials say leave ICE alone. Thomas Homan helped lead ICE during the Obama administration and under Trump. He's now a Fox News regular.
ICE will not be bullied into not enforcing laws in this country. Now, I can't blame anybody for wanting to be part of the greatest country on earth, but you can't want to be a part of the greatest country on earth and violate its laws. You can't have it both ways.
Julia Myers-Wood agrees. She led ICE for 2 years under Bush.
I understand the frustration, but I do think that what the agency does is a necessary thing for any country. Whether or not it's an agency called ICE, you know, you probably could break up the agency in different ways, but whether or not that would be more effective is up for grabs.
Some immigration advocates doubt a new administration will change ICE dramatically. Democratic nominee Joe Biden promises a 100-day stop to deportations and some changes to the detention system. This falls short for Donald Antonsen. He leads Families for Freedom, an advocacy group based in New York. He was also once held in a detention center and fought deportation to Antigua.
The system needs to be dismantled. The apparatus that pushes it, which is Homeland Security, needs to be dismantled.
For him, abolishing ICE won't be enough. Change must go deeper. He wants to see the U.S. welcome immigrants rather than punish them. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Once upon a time, there were no languages. Then at some point in human development, we began speaking to each other, eventually in ways that followed grammatical patterns. I'm not sure when irregular verbs entered the picture. There are theories about how language evolved, but the truth is, nobody really knows. Today, however, we know a little more thanks to a language that only came into being recently, Nicaraguan Sign Language.
My name is Yuri Shepherd Kegel.
Yuri is 29. She's deaf. She's signing these words to her adoptive mother, Judy, who's interpreting for her.
Right now, I'm at home in my home in Maine. I've lived here 13 years. I'm from Nicaragua.
Yuri was born without hearing. She didn't communicate much for the first few years of her life until she went to a school for the deaf.
When I was 4 years old, I entered the school, and that's where I started to learn Nicaraguan Sign Language.
So how exactly does Nicaraguan Sign Language tell us more about the human history of language and communication? Carol Zoll has our report.
The story starts in 1979. There was a left-wing insurrection in Central America.
Victorious Sandinista rebels marched into Nicaragua's capital city of Managua today.
In 1979, there was what they refer to as the triumph of the revolution. The Sandinista government took over.
That's Judy Shepherd Kegel, the woman who was interpreting for her daughter, Yuri. Judy teaches linguistics at the University of Southern Maine. Back in 1979, she was a young researcher. It was in the years after the revolution that Judy first got involved with Nicaragua. The new Sandinista government had big plans for their country.
They were involved in all kinds of promotions to get a fourth grade education for everyone, get people literacy, improve health care. You know, the literacy rate was horrendous.
As part of this drive for literacy, the government started providing special education for deaf kids in public schools. This was brand new for Nicaragua. Previously, most deaf children were completely isolated.
Deaf people were hidden in the homes. I mean, deaf people weren't even going to the churches. There was a real stigma.
But now, for the first time, hundreds of deaf children were brought together in a few schools in the capital city, Managua. Suddenly, there was a community of deaf kids, all trying to communicate with each other. And this is where the new language emerged. These kids, who had never been taught sign language, started signing with each other. Judy was invited by Nicaragua's Ministry of Education to come observe them. And the first place she went was a vocational school.
When I walked in, I said, "I'm a linguist. What do you want from me?" And they pointed to a bunch of kids milling around on a little basketball court in front of us and said, "We want to understand what they're talking about."
Now, not only had these kids never been taught sign language, but there just wasn't any sign language in Nicaragua. At all. At school, the children were being taught lip reading in Spanish and were told not to use gestures. But outside of the classroom, on the playground, on the school bus, they had found a way to communicate. They were gesturing with each other, using the signs they'd used at home with their families. Judy's role was to observe the students and try to figure out what they were saying.
So I was allowed to just kind of go into these classes, and I just watched what they were doing, and I could be there all day.
When the kids realized that Judy was studying them, they befriended her, started teaching her their signs. But as Judy began to understand them better, it seemed to her that they didn't actually have a full-fledged language. It was more like an elaborate system of gestures. After a couple of weeks, Judy went to see some younger kids at an elementary school.
And there, that's when I saw something very different.
The younger children were communicating much more fluently than the older kids, which is not what you might expect. Usually we think the older a child is, the better their language skills. But at this elementary school, the very youngest kids were actually the most fluent. It was as if fluency was going backwards. Judy knew that this is something that can happen when a new language comes into being.
And that made me realize, wait a minute, what am I looking at here?
Judy concluded that what she was looking at was the emergence of a brand new language. Judy believes that the younger kids were in the critical period for language, meaning their brains were very receptive to learning. They had spent lots of time with the older kids and been exposed to those gestures and signs that the older group was using. Judy thinks that that was the trigger for creating the new language.
The kids who really benefited from that input were 4, 5, 6.
Those children had no way of knowing that those gestures and signs weren't really a language.
So they learned it. It wasn't a language, but their brains filled in the holes of what was missing.
This is key to Judy's understanding of what happened. She believes that as long as we're given the right stimulus at the right time, our brains will produce language. And what she observed in Nicaragua confirmed that belief. In the decades since Judy's first trips to Nicaragua, many other scholars have traveled there to study the new language too. And because there was a new group of kids entering the elementary school in Managua each year, researchers have been able to compare successive generations of signers to see how the language has been changing over time. Molly Flaherty is a psychology professor at Davidson College. She's looked at how the size of the language has been changing from one generation to the next.
Yeah, like how large are the physical signs?
Flaherty asks people of different ages to describe the same event to her to see the differences in how they sign. She uses motion tracking technology to follow the position of people's wrists in space to measure the physical size of the signs.
So what we see in Nicaragua is that older signers, they sign larger than do younger signers. So that means like when they're articulating the same sign, their hands actually cover more space.
Molly thinks the change has to do with the older signers, the ones from the earliest generations, wanting to make sure they were understood, because larger signs would be easier to see. Younger signers today don't have that same pressure. They do expect to be understood.
Because they share a language the way that the vast majority of us here on Earth share a language with other people.
And that means that other factors can start to influence the language. Molly says that older signers are aware that the language is changing, not just the size of the signs, but also things like vocabulary. And at least some of them think that the younger signers are getting it all wrong.
Within the Nicaraguan sign community, you still, you know, will interact with people who will talk about how the kids are being so messy and so sloppy in their signing, and they're, you know, clearly ruining the language in this way or that way, just like you find everywhere else on Earth.
Studying these changes helps researchers test theories of why languages develop the way they do. And the fact that the language has emerged so quickly is striking.
It's not like it takes 100 years to get a language off the ground, and that's really good to know. That means that language is so integral to our human experience that basically give it half a chance to emerge, and it will.
Another reason linguists are fascinated by Nicaraguan Sign Language is because it allows them to study the way that children's brains influence language. When children are learning a language, they're not just passively absorbing words.
They're actually really active interpreters of the language that they're learning. They're analyzing it, and they are finding structure there, even sometimes when you didn't intend to put it there.
Children look for patterns in language, and when they find them, they favor the ones that occur most frequently. And in this way, over time, children drive the way a language develops.
Since kids are the primary language learners, they are the ones who are selecting for what stays in language, essentially.
That means that children have an outsized influence on language. Not just Nicaraguan Sign Language, but any language.
To think about the fact that this integral product that we all use every day, all day, may really be shaped by the youngest minds and by the youngest people in our world is, I don't know, I like that idea that we're all using this creation of children all the time and we don't necessarily realize it.
And that, of course, is what Nicaraguan Sign Language is, the creation of children. For the World, I'm Carol Zoll.
There's some environmental news coming out of Australia, and it's pretty upsetting. Nearly 400 pilot whales have died in a mass stranding on a sandbar off the coast of Tasmania. Around 90 have been saved, and rescue efforts are continuing, but some of the whales are too weak to be rescued and sadly are being euthanized. Anna Bunny has been following this closely. She's a head of education at Orca. That's a marine mammal protection organization based in the UK. The numbers are staggering here, Anna. More than 450 whales stranded, and most of them, unfortunately, unable to be saved by rescuers. How uncommon is a stranding of this size?
Unfortunately, mass strandings like this of pilot whales in particular is actually quite common. Pilot whales, they're very sociable creatures. They have extremely strong social bonds. Usually there's about 40 in a family pod, but often they come together in this case, over 400 of them. And unfortunately, it isn't uncommon, but this is a huge mass stranding.
What do we know about how that communal behavior affects our lives? I mean, is it connected to the mass stranding?
Very certainly, yeah. I mean, we can't be 100% sure why there is this mass stranding, but there's a lot of different theories. So they use echolocations. That's the same as what bats use.
Right.
So they use sound for finding their prey, for navigating, and for communicating with each other. And on these sandbars, it's really hard for them to use this echolocation because there's not very much sort of hard structures for these sonar sounds to bounce back off. So they think that they're in much deeper waters than they actually are. And one or two of them might become stranded. So they send out these distress signals. So more whales come to them to kind of rescue them, see if they're okay. And unfortunately, they get stranded in the process as well.
I mentioned rescue efforts have been underway. What's involved in a rescue attempt like this? Like, what considerations have to be kept in mind?
It's a huge, huge rescue operation. I mean, the whales that are in slightly deeper water, they can kind of herd them out using their boats. The whales that are in quite shallow waters, people are trying to physically move them. But these are huge animals. They're huge marine mammals. The males can grow up to 7.5 meters long and weigh 3,000 kilograms.
So that's like almost 25 feet or something.
Yeah, they're huge. So they're using sort of little pontoons, which are basically bits of fabric that you can put under the animals and then pump them up full of air to try and refloat them and push them out. But the problem they have is that these animals are still hearing those distress signals. So they're re-stranding once they have been refloated. And unfortunately, some of the efforts have been changed from rescuing animals to actually getting rid of the bodies on the shore.
What impact could a stranding of this size have on the future of the pilot whales there?
I mean, it's going to have a huge impact. This is a massive number, but pilot whales, they're not the most endangered of all the cetacean species. So cetaceans are whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Mm. If anything, it does raise awareness of these amazing creatures. So hopefully people will learn more about them and do more in their everyday lives to protect them, whether that's using less disposable plastic every day or, you know, using their car less to contribute to climate change, you know. It will have an impact, but it's not going to be sort of an extinction impact.
Anna Bunny is head of education at Orca, a marine mammal protection organization in the UK. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Thank you so much.
When reporting on climate change, let's be honest, most of the news is pretty bleak. Like right now, devastating wildfires in the west of the US and in Brazil's Amazon. In China, Pakistan, and Sudan, floods have left tens of thousands of people without homes. We don't want to ignore these tragedies, obviously, but there is another way to look at the climate story. Our next guest has spent years spotting the good news on global warming and the environment for her new book, The Reindeer Chronicles. That's on today's installment of The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Author Judy Schwartz's stories take us from China to Norway and Saudi Arabia to Hawaii. In your stories, in your writing, Judy, you focus on something you call Earth Repair. You describe it as a grassroots response to evolving crises, an antidote to despair. Explain what you mean by earth repair and how you see it as one solution to climate change.
Yeah, so when I talk about earth repair, it basically means healing our landscapes and our seascapes. And the thing is that we hear about all this devastating news, but one thing that has been neglected in our conversations about climate is the role of functioning ecosystems to climate regulation. And the reason that this is good news is that it gives us tremendous agency because we know that we can restore ecosystems from huge landscapes, like you mentioned in China, where an area the size of Belgium was returned to ecological health, to smaller projects and places. And ecological health on every scale matters.
So functioning ecosystems where things are working. You mentioned China and the Loess Plateau, this area around the Yellow River that stretches across 7 provinces and what happened there starting in the 90s. Talk about that restoration. What did it look like? How did it happen? And what did you learn from reporting this story?
This is an area where it was the breadbasket of China, and it's actually where agriculture developed in China 10,000 years ago. And over all that time, the land has degraded to the point where you see images of people bringing their goats up hillsides where maybe there's a few blades of grass. And the Yellow River was silting up, and it was a real disaster. So the Chinese government, in conjunction with numerous international entities, including the World Bank, decided that rather than have this ongoing problem, they would restore the landscape. They used some very simple approaches. They terraced the land so that the water would flow more slowly and water would be held in the landscape. They removed animals from where they had been overgrazing so that the land would have a chance to rebound. And they had local people planting trees and planting other kinds of vegetation. And the extraordinary thing is that within 14 years, what had been a wasteland was filled with green, and 2 million people were brought out of poverty.
What were the downsides of that when it came to actually executing it?
Well, it was an ongoing challenge to do anything on such a large scale. There is, of course, a lot of, you know, trial and error. But overall, the project was a huge success. And in fact, one of my motivations for writing this book was to make it clear that these kinds of projects are happening. We may not see them. You know, it's not a dramatic one-day news story. But all over the world, people are experimenting. They are enhancing the climate resilience of their landscapes. They are turning wastelands into places where people can grow their own food and live their own lives with dignity.
Practically every day on our show, we cover environmental disasters and the daunting challenge of climate change. Why is highlighting these success stories important to you when, as I mentioned earlier, there are literally fires that urgently need to be dealt with?
Well, one thing is that I think it's so important for people to even know that it's possible to restore landscapes. Land is never static. It's always in the process of changing. And by working with natural processes, we can help to restore those landscapes. And in doing so, restore climate regulation. I think it's really important for us to be curious about how land works, and that can help us address problems such as fires by not being just reactive with all of these different tragedies that are unfolding before our eyes, but to also think about landscapes, think about how these lands might be restored, look at who is out there doing the restoring and what we can learn from what they are doing.
Judy Schwartz is the author of The Reindeer Chronicles, just out. Thanks for being with us, Judy. Really appreciate your time.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Now someone else who's reported a lot on the environment. He's traveled to the world's rainforests, Arctic tundras, and vast deserts.
What we do now and in the next few years.
Yes, that voice. Now he's on the gram.
My name is David Attenborough, and I've been appearing on radio and television for the past 60 years. But this is my first time on Instagram.
That was from David Attenborough's first post, went up today. Within hours, the 94-year-old topped 1 million followers. Old dogs, new tricks. A trick with a purpose.
And I'm making this move and exploring this new way of communication to me because, as we all know, the world is in trouble. Continents are on fire. Glaciers are melting. Coral reefs are dying. Fish are disappearing from our oceans. The list goes on and on.
Attenborough's Instagram debut comes as his team rolls out a new book and Netflix documentary called A Life on Our Planet. It reflects on Attenborough's career witnessing the decline of the world's biodiversity firsthand.
Over the next few weeks, I'll be recording messages to explain what the problems are and how we can deal with them. Join me, or as we used to say in those early days of radio,
stay tuned.
We will. Attenborough's Instagram account is being managed by some of his longtime collaborators who admit the online world is not his natural habitat. Saving the planet, though, requires everyone to get a little bit outside of their comfort zone. If you want to see what we're seeing, our Instagram account is at PRI The World, where you can always find us. This old dog is on the gram, at Marco Werman, one word. As they also used to say in the early days of radio, signing off for now from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Tomorrow's Friday, don't you know? We'll see you back here then.